Good evening, friends. Tonight will be a bit different from the way we have been meeting in the past four evenings. We will discuss meditation, and before that we will go into the nature of consciousness. The consciousness we will look to will be our own consciousness. And so we say it is a little different because we do not have any handouts tonight. What we will do is to look into our own consciousness, and that will be the handout for tonight. And then we will go into meditation. Some have asked, a number of them have said, well, what can I do right after this series of meetings? What can I do in my daily life to somehow put into practice the things we have studied? That is why we have called these approaches to the spiritual life. But before we go to that, we might just review very quickly what we have covered for the four evenings. So in our last meeting, we talked about the law of cyclicity, that there is a periodic manifestation of certain laws in nature, and they occur during certain cycles. And part of this has been what we called karma and the idea of reincarnation. Then before that, we went to our human nature. The highlight of this is that it points out that within our human nature is a resident or potential divinity within us that awaits its awakening, that we are not simply the bodies that we have, our emotions, our thoughts and our physical nature, that there is a principle much deeper within us that can be discovered, that can be explored, that can be brought out into its full potential. Then we went also into the nature of the universe, particularly our system, pointing out that there is a world other than the physical world that we experience, that there are other states of consciousness and other states of matter and energy beyond the physical. And before that, in our first meeting, we touched some of the general principles of what we call basic theosophy. Among them are, for example, the unity of the one life, that although there are many lives that we observe around us, there is really behind every life simply one life, one universal consciousness that vivifies all these observations that we make. Then we touch on the idea of evolution and involution, that in the universe that we live, there is a constant manifestation. And from these manifestations, it goes back from where it came from. Then the idea of order, that there is order in the universe. Things do not happen in happenstance or by chance or by probability. Behind that is a system, an order, a kind of hierarchy in which things manifest in quite a harmonious way. Then we touch on ideas like the idea of self-transformation, that within us is the potential to transform ourselves, and that within our deepest nature is the nature of consciousness, and that we cannot understand anything outside of us or within us unless we understand first our own consciousness, because we use consciousness to understand whatever we're trying to understand. And so tonight, this is what we will go into much deeper, into this consciousness we speak of. We will really speak of our own consciousness. Now, from hence on, kindly while listening, not so much to dwell on the words that we are using. Of course, we use words and we use language. We are trying to speak about something that transcends words, and we are just using words. So try to catch that which we are trying to say rather than that which has been actually said. Now we will use terms, we will try to be as accurate as we can, but really our own criteria will be our own consciousness. So also, when statements are made from hence on, kindly not to accept them right away, no matter how logical they are, neither to also reject them immediately because somehow they are not familiar. So we will just place our consciousness in a state where we are just learning and observing our own consciousness, neither to accept and neither to reject. Whatever we accept or reject finally will be our own decision. We will do so only in accordance with our own realizations, not somebody else. Then later on after that, we will go into some practical approaches that one can do right away beginning tomorrow morning about meditation, how one can go much deeper into this consciousness we will try to experience this evening, and then there to verify it for oneself in one's own life. Now we will begin with our consciousness. So whatever we are talking now is not so much in the words we are saying as much as we are merely trying to describe what is really taking place within us, within ourselves. So as we listen to the words, much more it is better to listen to what is happening really within our own consciousness. Now, when we speak about consciousness, the first consciousness that is undeniable, to which we are very much involved with, is the consciousness of the five senses. Really, if we take away the five senses, strictly speaking, ordinarily, normally, we say we cannot have any consciousness whatsoever. We may have ideas of higher consciousness, but as far as we are here in this physical world, the basis of whatever consciousness we have are the five senses. Now, one will find that the five senses do not operate simply by themselves. Unless there are objects around us, the senses somehow cannot really function all by themselves. We will not probably be aware that they are there unless somehow there are objects that somehow the senses are applied to. Now, the senses in itself is an object, so if we apply it to itself, then we are aware of the senses. So if we look around us, what we find is there are so many objects around us. So maybe we can write this on the board here. So we have here objects around us. And we were saying that we have our senses. And it is only when our senses get in touch with the objects that the senses really now begin to function. And the basis of our ordinary consciousness, we said, are the senses, as they somehow come in touch or in contact with the objects around us. So we will put here the word contact. So these three must take place to have the ordinary consciousness that we have. Now, the moment the senses makes contact with the objects around us, then we have now the experience of sensations that take place now within our consciousness. So the basis of the sensations or sensation consciousness within us is real this contact of the senses with the objects around us. The moment we take away any one of these, somehow consciousness, or the ordinary way, cannot take place within us. If there is no contact, what can we be conscious of? So we are conscious of the blackboard, so there is an object there. With our senses, it makes contact through light waves and so on, and the different parts of the eye, the optical nerves and the rods and so on, and then the brain. Then we have a feeling now of what we call sensation or sensation, seeing sensation consciousness. Now, although we live in this world with so many objects around us to which the five senses come in contact with, one will find that we really do not come in contact with the objects directly, or in fact even observe them or perceive them directly. That which we really perceive, or that which we see, are really not the objects, but simply the sensations that are generated within our consciousness. Isn't it? So, from this, we have what we might call now perception. So the moment we say here is an object and we have the eye, the senses, it makes contact. We have now seeing or sensation, or seeing sensation, consciousness. What is really happening is that we do not perceive the blackboard directly, and this is not being philosophical or trying to hair split. What we really are perceiving are the sensations that are taking place within us. In fact, no scientist can, no matter how famous they are, can ever really say they are completely objective. They may use certain instruments, let's say a telescope, looking at a star out there. They look through the telescope and they say, I see the star. Really, we do not see the star. What we see or perceive are the sensations within us of the senses that come in contact with the star, comes in contact with the star through this telescope. And that is what they see within them. So in a way, all experience, somehow even physical experience, is really subjective, because that which we perceive are the sensations within us. And these sensations are not out there. What are out there are the objects. The senses are very close to us. Then a contact is made. But these sensations which take place are really within our own consciousness. And this is what we perceive. So like the blackboard, we do not perceive the blackboard directly. What we perceive are sensations within us, within our consciousness of the blackboard. And the same can be applied to almost any object whatsoever in the physical world. You can take any science, even a biologist, who may not use a telescope to look at the macro things. He may look at the micro things. And so he looks maybe at a leaf. They do not see the leaf. What they see are sensations inside their heads or their consciousness of the leaf. And they do not see the leaf directly. Now, this is happening within our consciousness, and really it is a process. The senses reaching for objects and making the contact, generating sensations, and then there is a perception now of the sensation within us. The perception follows together with the sensation. Then when this perception takes place, what happens is certain images now are generated or created within our consciousness. This is not in the blackboard. We are describing a process of consciousness that is taking place within us. So kindly to see it not so much the way it is written in the blackboard, as much as right now to experience it within our own consciousness. So once there is a perception, we now have what we might call the generation of images. So the images are reflections of that, of the object that is being perceived through the sensations. So there might be dimensions, color, if you touch it, feel, and so on. And these images are based now on the perception of the sensation. And really this perception is not direct towards that object. And we can take any object whatsoever. Then once these images are formed, then now a thought is created. Now what happens with this thought? This thought now, it's an idea. This thought now gets collected within our consciousness. We start collecting them. And so we collect this, and now it begins to accumulate within our consciousness. So we will draw this to show the accumulation. Now, from the time we can recall and remember that we have come in contact with objects and maybe become aware of our senses, to the time we have lived throughout in this world, to the time we are here now in this library, how many objects have we encountered? Now, when we ask this question, obviously it is not possible really to count them. What we are trying to do is to arrive at the impact of it within our own consciousness and to realize it. How many objects have we come in contact with? generating sensations, perceiving these sensations, and this perception generating images and thoughts, and then we accumulate this within our consciousness. How many thoughts have we accumulated? Assuming that for every object, maybe there might be one thought. In fact, for every object, there really is more than one thought. But assuming there is one-to-one, how many accumulations, how many thoughts have we accumulated within our consciousness? So let us, for example, take one of the senses. Let us say the sense of seeing. If we take one object, let us say blackboard, and we have one sense, seeing, and we see this, the question would be, what is the minimum number of thoughts, the minimum, that can be generated within our consciousness? One sense, one object. One. Be one, right? At least be sure about this. It's one. All right. One sense, one object, the minimum would be one. All right. So we see this, there's a blackboard, we see this, that's one thought. Supposing we do not see the blackboard, we touch it like this, we don't see it, that is one sense, the sense of touch, and one object. What is the minimum number of thoughts now that can be generated? Also one. Without this thing, just the touch. One. So, in other words, one sense, one object, one thought. So, if we have two senses, like seeing and touching, and one object, since we have two senses, seeing and touching, we would have two thoughts, although there's only one object. Now, would we say that seeing without touching and touching without seeing would be different from seeing and touching together? And that would be a different thought. So, the moment we have two senses and one object, there would be at least two thoughts, but the combination of these two senses would generate another thought. So in effect, there would be three thoughts. Now, we are not counting for the sake of counting. What we're trying to do is to get the impact of this within our own consciousness. Now, if we have five senses, without combining them, and we have one object, of course, no one ever tastes a blackboard. But let's say, assuming, you know, we put our tongue and licked it just to pursue our point. But if we had five senses and one object, then the minimum number of thoughts would be one thought for every sense. We would now have five thoughts, although we have only one object. Then we said the moment we combine, then another thought can be generated. Now, if we take all the combinations, let's say 1 and 2, 1 and 3, and then there is what they call permutation, you know, 1 and 2 combined together with the 3. So if we take the permutation and combination of 5, what would be the maximum number of thoughts in relation to one object? 5. In other words, n equals 5, the number of permutation combinations is 5, and you have one object. What are the possible combinations and permutations of 5? How many would there be? Maximum now. 45. How many would there be? The formula for this is 5 factorial, like that. 5 exclamation mark. It's called factorial in mathematics. And it's an exclamation mark because what it means is 5 times 4 times 3 times 2 times 1. That is the possible combination, permutation of 5. In one place, this came up, and this was somewhere in the West Coast, and someone gave the answer 120. The answer is 120. And I found out later on, he was the one who, you know, this Texas Instrument, they make these calculators. He was one of the writers of the manual. You know, and he shut it out like that. And so we have here 5 times 4, 20. 20 times 3, 60. 60 times 2, 120. 120 times 1, 120. Now, we are not just counting here for the sake of counting. What we're saying is, if one object and five senses, assuming now all of them are involved, can generate 120 thoughts, and we said nobody licks a blackboard, so let's drop 20 and just say about 100 thoughts to one object. From the time we can remember we have encountered objects to the time we are here now in this room, assuming for every object there can be 100 thoughts, how many thoughts have we accumulated within our consciousness? And this is what we're trying to get, the impact of this within our consciousness. So we go through life encountering all these objects, and it becomes more complicated now. We do not sometimes now have to go after objects. The objects pursue us now with our advertising, promotions, newspapers, you know, ads and so on. They almost pursue us. And so through life, we go in our encounter with objects, generating thoughts that correspond to them. So within our consciousness, the thoughts now accumulate thought upon thought upon thought upon thought within our consciousness, until finally the entire accumulation of thoughts begin to assume a self of its own within us. So now this is what they call the false self, or the illusion of the separate self. It is called the illusion of the separate self, but first of all, it is an illusion. It is merely an accumulation of thoughts. And our original consciousness becomes identified with this accumulation. It is called the illusion of the separate self, separate, because the accumulations that each of us have are different from each other, depending on, you know, where we are born, our culture, our tradition, our educational system, the parents we have been born to, how we have been raised, the community, and so on. The exposures we have had, society in which we live. So the thoughts that we encounter and accumulate within our consciousness become different from each other. So because we have different accumulations, we feel we have a separate identity, but that we are different from each other. And so here now we have the illusion of the separate self. If we have the same accumulations, we will feel a kind of oneness. For example, in the society, we speak about brotherhood. It is very easy to be brotherly with someone who has more or less the same accumulation of thoughts that we have. I recall someone who went to a theosophical lecture, and I asked him, how did you like the lecture? Oh, very much. He thinks like me. So it is very easy to get along and to be brotherly the moment we have the same accumulation. But the moment somebody's accumulation is very different, radically different from our own accumulation, it is very difficult to be brotherly. Why? We feel separate. We are different. And we see this happen. Different religions, different philosophies, different schools of thought in science, different social structures and exposures that we have had in our consciousness, these differences differentiate the thoughts that are accumulated, and because of this, we feel separate from each other. And this creates now the illusion of the separate self. Now, selves or accumulations that tend to have the same contents tend to bond themselves together or come together. They can get along fine, and so they group themselves together. Those that have different separate from each other. In fact, this is even how armies are formed. People who have the same thoughts, and that is part of the training, by the way, so that they are given the same thoughts, and they call this propaganda and all that. And then because they are the same, they bond themselves together against another group of accumulations that have different accumulations. And these accumulations that bond themselves or come together to form armies may fight and clash with each other and kill each other's bodies just because what they have accumulated in their consciousness are different from each other. They can be political ideologies, they can be religious ideas, They can be schools of thought, whatever they are, because they are different. They try to convince each other, and because there is no disagreement, there is no agreement rather, then they can destroy each other's bodies because of these differences. And so we see this in life. The resolution of this begins only within our own consciousness. We cannot change somebody else's accumulation. We can only look into our own accumulation in the manner that it relates to other accumulations. In fact, we are not even supposed to relate to the accumulation, to transcend the accumulations. And so, two people with different accumulations can come together, and they will even try to save each other's soul and say, you know, you have the wrong accumulation. That accumulation you have will not lead you to heaven. You will go to hell. So maybe if you have this, then maybe it will save your soul. I have the right accumulation. You have the wrong accumulation, and that's too bad for you. And so maybe, I'm sure you have seen, people speak now with bumper stickers. I am saved. Can I throw you a rope? And this is going on. Once, this was on a plane on the way to the West Coast, coming from here, and that's a over 3-hour flight. Someone who just finished the ministry of 6 years was being assigned now, just graduated. And for 3 hours, he was trying to save my soul. Of course, he didn't know I was, you know, we were in these things. I just sat very quietly, and I found out he was a new graduate, and I was trying to understand what was going on. And I said, this is nice. I have met someone whom I can get into. So I just listened very carefully. And of course, everything was biblical, and that's fine. Then when we were almost landing, I asked him, would you say that everything you have told me are thoughts about God or truth, and they are not God himself or truth itself? They are merely thoughts. It's the accumulation now, the thought accumulation. And then he agreed. He said, yes. He said, would you say that any thought I have or image would be a symbol or a representation of a truth? And then he said, yes. So for almost 3 hours, we were talking about God. He was saving my soul. So I said, would you say that therefore all these thoughts that you have told me are not really God himself, but merely images, their thoughts and symbols about him, and therefore it is not God himself? And then he agreed. So I asked him, what is the first commandment? And of course, he didn't remember. He said, oh, I just finished ministry school. I can't remember. But that could be understandable. He was very concerned about maybe saving somebody's soul, and that's fine. And he meant very well. He was a very nice man. In fact, the stewardess leaned over and said, you know, I'm going to this place, and I've never been there. And I could sense she wanted probably to be invited and shown around, and he didn't even bat an eye and look at her. So I said, he's all right. He did his ministry training very well. Then the first commandment goes like, I am the Lord thy God. And he remembered it right away. He said, oh yes, that's right. Thou shalt have no other false gods before me, you know, and there shall be no graven images. And what are really the most grave of graven images? Are they not the thoughts? In fact, no image, physical image, can be created unless first, back of it, there is a graven image in the image of thought. Then I said, therefore, if we are trying to get in touch with God or the divine, and we have all these thoughts that are graven images of him, would you say, therefore, then I'm already violating now the first commandment? If not the first, at least the second. Then he said, oh my God, what have I been doing for 3 hours? Because it was about 3 hours. And I listened very, very carefully. And this is what we mean with this accumulation. We accumulate this. We can have thoughts about God, about truth, about reality, the universe, the masters, whatever they are. They can be very, very beautiful. We do not belittle them. They have their proper place in life. but we say one must finally go beyond them. They are simply representations, symbols of truth, of reality, but they are not reality itself, although they participate in reality. The basic reality is our consciousness in the manner that these thoughts now affect our consciousness. And that which affects our consciousness is this accumulation. And so we look at the world with these accumulations, and therefore we cannot understand the world, anything outside of us or inside of us, beyond the understanding of our own accumulations. And we do not even determine this. Our parents, our society, the mass media, radio, TV, books, literature, they all determine what we will accumulate. In fact, sometimes we are even threatened to make these accumulations, or else we will not be saved, and so on. There is fear, and so we accumulate these thoughts. What we are trying to do is to look into this process in the manner that it takes place within our consciousness. So we have this accumulation. Within this accumulation, something else goes on also. So we'll make another diagram here. This self now makes observations. So we will have here observations. So our original consciousness becomes identified with this self, and it makes observations. On the basis of its observations, it makes descriptions. Isn't it so? Here are these thoughts now. It can observe its thoughts, or it can observe objects. While it goes through this, within itself, there is a smaller cycle going within it. And this is not in the blackboard. We're trying to describe something within our consciousness. So it observes, and then it makes descriptions, and then on the basis of descriptions, then it makes interpretations. Then what does it do with the interpretation? It makes evaluations, isn't it? It evaluates on the basis of the interpretation. Then it analyzes, and then it weighs it, and then evaluates it. Then, on the basis of the evaluation now, it reacts. So we have here now reaction. On the basis of the reaction, a belief now is confirmed within it. Belief. And finally, these thoughts now that has been accumulated become converted into beliefs. I believe in this. Why? Because it has made its own observations, it has described it, and made interpretations of its own, evaluated it, reacted, and then confirmed it within itself, and it says now, I believe in this. On the basis of belief, then now it lives its life in the world. And really, one is not aware of these details. All that we are aware of is simply the objects out there and the world in which we live in. And this process, almost unconscious, is taking place within us. The study of theosophy and these things we have around us, really, its experiential nature takes place the moment we turn this consciousness inward. So the books, the theories, the ideas and conceptions are very, very helpful. But finally, a time comes, we would like to experience this for ourselves. When that time comes, this consciousness, which is turned outward, must finally be turned inward. Even within the society, sometimes comments are made by some members. They say, I have been so long within the society, somehow I have not found anything new anymore. I'm not learning anything new anymore. It's the same thing almost over and over again. When something like that happens, that means that person has stopped looking into oneself. It is only when we turn the consciousness inward that finally the things that we know in thoughts, ideas within our mind, take a new light, because there we begin to check it within our consciousness. This is how a belief system is formed within this accumulation of thoughts, making its own observations, descriptions, its own interpretations, evaluations, reactions, and then now it becomes a belief, and now here is a walking system of belief. If it encounters an accumulation that has a different belief of its own, then it cannot be brotherly. It might fight, and even it might even go to the extent of killing, just because the belief system is different from it. By looking into these processes that take place within our consciousness is the beginning of meditation. So this accumulation now will say, it has assumed a self of its own. So it might listen to talks like this or read books and says, oh, it says that the key now is in meditation. So this accumulation says now, I am going now to meditate. Notice, I am going to meditate, this self. Supposing this accumulation sits down and meditate, or may even stand on its head, how many meditations will bring it into realization? Or what can it realize other than that which it contains within itself? So this accumulation, which is assumed now as self of its own, can do 1,000 to 1,000,000 meditations. It cannot realize anything other than that which it contains within itself. Meditation is the silencing of this, the silencing. This whole thing must be silent. It must be quiet. It must be stopped. In yoga, they call this modification. It is a modification in consciousness. The thoughts here, these accumulations, modify our consciousness. The modern term used in psychology is alteration. It alters our consciousness. The thing in psychology and parapsychology is that while they speak of alteration, while they are very helpful in the sense that they somehow subscribe to some of the ideas we have been bringing forth for the past 100 years, they speak about a higher consciousness, and they point out that it is merely an alteration of consciousness that one might experience this higher or deeper kind of consciousness within us. And so they say all you have to do is do this, and you alter your consciousness from this lower consciousness to this higher consciousness. Now, we might disagree a bit on this. Probably it's merely in the use of words. In a state of meditation, what we are doing is not altering our consciousness from a lower to a higher form of consciousness. What we are trying to do is to stop all the alterations of consciousness, to stop all the alterations. And what is that that alters our consciousness? The objects, the senses, the contact, the sensations, the perception, the images, the thoughts, the accumulation. This alters our original consciousness. The observations that we make here now within this accumulation, descriptions, all of these are alterations. That is why all of this finally must stop. These modifications, these alterations must come to a stop, completely quiet and completely still. When that has been achieved, in fact, we do not achieve it. All we can do is to be still. It achieves us. We probably do not realize truth, God, divinity, or this higher consciousness. All we can do is to simply stop. It realizes us. So you recall our differentiation between prayer and meditation. Prayer is when we talk to God. But in our talking with God, when we say, God, I stop talking. You talk to me and I listen. This is meditation. But usually, we pray and then we talk to God. Then when God is about to answer us, then we say amen because we have already talked, and then we walk away. So we can do all the talking that we want. Then after the talking has been done, before we say amen, maybe probably say, God, you do the talking now. You have the floor. I'll shut up and I will listen. Then after that, we say amen. But usually we say amen before that and walk away. So when we talk to God, this is prayer. When he talks to us and we are silent and quiet and listening, this now is meditation. Now some might ask, what can I do now if I like to meditate? Now this is not for those who have a certain committed form of meditation they have adopted on their own. This is merely for those who are looking around and finding something that they can try on their own. And this is very safe because there is no concentration of any parts of the body involved, no breathing, complicated exercises. It's very simple. There is a time in one's life when we said we would like to experience for ourselves. And when that time comes, meditation now has a role to play. If one is serious about meditation, a decision has to be made in one's life that we are going to meditate. That meditation, as a way of life now, is part and parcel of the life we live in the world. And this decision is made like we would decide transferring a house, marrying the man of our dreams or girl of our dreams, or taking in a job, or quitting, or transferring. We make big decisions like this in life, whether we are going to spend money or not, if there is a big amount or a small amount. We make decisions like this, and this decision to meditate is part of this. So take time out, be quiet, sit quietly, resolve within one's consciousness the decision now to incorporate meditation in one's life. So this decision has to be made. Now, once this decision has been made, it is very helpful to set aside a place exclusively for meditation. It simply is helpful. We do not say that if one does not have an exclusive place, one will not realize. We simply say that it is helpful. So in our homes, we have a kitchen to cook, we have a bedroom to sleep, living room for our visitors. Some people even have a wet bar and things like that. Then we have a basement for the junk, an attic for the junk, and a garage also for the junk. And we have all these special places for special activities in our life. The question is, do we have one little place for the highest function that we might perform on our earth life? Is our highest function on earth, like if we were to maybe pass away at the end of our life, if we were to meet God face to face and he would say, my son, my daughter, what have you done on earth? Well, I went to the kitchen, I went to the bathroom, I went to the living room, I went to the bedroom. Is there a place where we can say, God, I put a little place there where I was trying to find you? So it is helpful to set aside a special place. I have traveled to probably by now around 30 states and over 100 places. In these travels, I've encountered so far only 7 homes with a meditation room exclusively for meditation. 7 out of over 100. Probably there are others, it did not come to my attention. So it is helpful if a room can be placed, that would be the ideal. But rent is a premium now. So if that is not possible, let there be even one little corner, one little chair, and nothing will be done there except merely to meditate. And it is helpful. It is a kind of reminder. You know, you walk around the house, you see the stove, oh, I have to cook. You see the vacuum cleaner, you know, I have to clean the house. So you see this chair or this cushion, and say, well, the meditation has come to be done. So set aside a place. And it is best to meditate in the morning. So set a fixed time during which meditation can be done. One can experiment with whatever way you like, but somehow the morning is somehow the best time to meditate. In the afternoon, one comes from work, you're tired, fighting the traffic and all that, then one is quite exhausted. Not only that, if you work in the city or any place, then all the vibes there, we carry this within our consciousness, and it takes quite a while before it settles down. So the morning is the best. All these negative vibes, vibration generated during the day, physically, emotionally, mentally, because people are asleep, have settled down during the night. And so the atmosphere and environment is quite clear. The brain also rested, the body is rested. Then since we have already slept, the chances of also at a minimal stage. So set a fixed time, the best time in the morning. Once the morning has come, get up right away. It is said, the morning, when a fixed time is set for meditation, the biggest problem is not so much waking up, because that is easy. All one has to do is to open one's eyelids. The hard part follows, and that is the getting up. And we know this. That is why, these alarm clocks where there is a, is it 2 minutes or 5 minutes allowance, you know, like, You tap it, then it will ring after another 2-3 minutes. They call this the 40 wink allowance. So if it fails, another 40 winks, because the getting up is the hard part. Now, the getting up is part of the discipline. The idea is to take command of one's physical body and one's emotions and one's mental nature. And so we talk to the body and say, now it's time to get up. Of course, one can experiment. Even before going to sleep, one can tell the body and say, I like you to get up at this hour. So if you set it, let's say, 6:30, 7, whatever, you tell the body, I want you to get up, let's say 7 o'clock, I'd like you to get up at 6:59, and one will find, you know, so that if in that 6:59 the body does not get up, then the alarm can, like the backup system, you know, can come up and then we wake up. So say 6:59, 1 or 2 minutes, and one will find as one does this, somehow the body begins to obey. And this is the power of one's consciousness based on consciousness. Right? So we set a fixed time in the morning. Now it is helpful that before one goes to sleep, whatever we do in the entire day, to the time we go to sleep, it is helpful that before we go to sleep, the last thoughts that we have are of the nature of the spiritual things that we are looking for. So it is helpful to read spiritual books that are enlightening and uplifting. So read this and go to sleep on the thoughts that are spiritual in nature. And these are our last thoughts. In a way, the meditation to some extent has already begun. These are the favorite of theosophists. At the feet of the master, light on the path, voice of the silence. If we can add the Bible, particularly chapters 5, 6, and 7, Matthew, and some other parts, if you feel it uplifts and it is inspiring. Some go to the exotic religions, like the Bhagavad Gita, and whatever we feel uplifts us. So take this reading material, and whatever you do before going to sleep, read this. And usually when we are reading something, there are certain passages there where we feel like underlining, and we say, oh, this is a nice thought. Now, maybe that's a good place to stop. And so we feel like underlining it. What we do now is to underline it in our memory within our minds. And then we sort of go to sleep on it. The next morning, we've set now the time for meditation. So when you get up, it is helpful now to go to the bathroom so that when nirvana comes, there is no interruption. So go to the bathroom. And by the way, because we sit down, you know, the poisons can circulate within the body. So we get rid of this, and one lightens also oneself. So there are some who ask, shall I sit on the floor or sit on a chair? It does not matter. Probably in the Western world, it is much easier to sit on a chair. But I have not found an ideal meditation chair. There are meditation cushions, but there is no meditation chair that I've found that is ideal. It must be one where it is almost orthopedic, you know, where it keeps the spinal column erect, and maybe there's an arm, so if you space out, you don't fall out. This rarely happens, though, but it's helpful to have an arm and things like this. So if you're looking for an idea for making your first million, make a meditation chair. There's none in the market. You'll have no competition. A lot of cushions. Now, if you sit on the floor, there is no question that the legs will go to sleep. No question about that. It will go to sleep. Of course, you can experiment with it. One can watch the sleeping of the legs. Fortunately, it does not go above the waist. The legs sleep and then it stops somewhere here. And that's dangerous, because if it goes up, it can arrest the heart. But fortunately, it only stops here, because then the veins and the circulatory system in the legs are somehow stopped. That's fine. In fact, it can be watched, and you will find that even if it is cropped, the consciousness can go out of it and it's not painful, and you go back to it, then it is painful. But we just be kind to it if you're doing sitting. So then, after the sitting, slowly unwrap the legs, and just be kind to it, slowly the blood will rush and it will pass away. Of course, it will be painful. But one will find it can be experimented where the consciousness can get into the pain and out of it. But whatever it is, make a choice, sitting on the chair or sitting on the floor. Some young people like to sit cross-legged. Probably they're young, their bodies are still flexible. Besides, they read a lot of yoga books and they come across what is called the lotus posture or the Padmasana posture. And that sounds very spiritual, and so they say, I meditate in the Padmasana posture. Well, I found out that sitting on a chair is called the Bodhisattva posture. So that is also exotic. Bodhi meaning truth, meaning enlightenment, you know, bodhi, or to realize, to experience, and sattva meaning truth. So Bodhisattva posture, the posture that brings the enlightenment in relation to truth or sattva. So make a choice. The thing is, if one is traveling and you're used to a chair, then if one does not have one's favorite meditation chair, then it bothers one a little bit. But if you sit on the floor, you can sit almost, you know, anywhere under a tree. But make a choice. So long as the important thing is one has started to meditate. Then it is helpful to keep the spinal column erect. Of course, there are some who say, well, I know a certain person who meditates lying down. So why don't I meditate lying down? If one is beginning meditation and meditates lying down, there is no question one will go to sleep. There is no question about that. The lying down posture for meditation is an advanced posture. You see, 45 degrees or 90 degrees from the horizontal is the spinal column erect. The moment we are 89 degrees, so one more degree would be 90 degrees. So the farther we are from the perpendicular posture, perpendicularity, if we are 89 degrees from perpendicular, we are 1 degree closer to sleep. The moment we are on horizontal, then we are just about ready to go to sleep. Why? Because in meditation, the suggestion is to close one's eyes. There are some who say, well, you stare and all that. But while you stare anyway, it looks like the eye isn't looking anyway, then you will find it will naturally close. Right, so sit erect, balance the head. There are two ways of balancing the head. Either put a book and balance it, or raise the hands upward, stretch without straining, and then gradually bring it down, and one will find that the spinal column is erect. Then we close our eyes, and we take a few deep breaths. In taking the breath, you experiment with it, but it is helpful to exhale first. You can experiment with it, you know, exhale. Then hold a little bit. We don't say if you don't do this, we won't realize. It just are some helpful little things. So exhale and then hold a little bit. And then just when we are really looking for air, just release and let go. And you will find that the natural rhythm of breathing will take place. So exhale, hold, and then release. Without any effort, the air will rush in, then just let go. And that helps in the relaxation. By the way, friends, it is breathing that relaxes and not smoking. So people say, you know, you smoke, you see this advertisement, you know, come to Marlboro country or something like that. And they say it will relax you and all that. It is not smoking that relaxes. It is the breathing in smoking that relaxes. So we might say breathing relaxes in spite of the smoke. The smoke merely interferes. So if people smoke and then they inhale and then exhale, and they say, oh, this cigarette relaxes me. You can throw away the cigarette and do the same thing. Inhale and exhale, and it will relax even much better because the nicotine and all that isn't there. So it is the smoking that relaxes. For those who are smoking, you can experiment. Get a straw and cut it so there is no tobacco inside. You can make it long, so it will be, what do they say, you've come a long way, baby, you know. Make it long. And then, you know, pull the air in and then exhale, and you'll find that it will be relaxing. It is the air and the breathing that relaxes. So we sit down, and then we breathe now and relax. Of course, we close the eyes. Do what you like with your hands. Just be relaxed, either on the knee or wherever it is most comfortable. Then say any mantra. If you believe in mantras, say the mantra if you like. If there is none, that's fine. Try to make a greeting to the invisible beings in the invisible worlds. Now, we are entering another world, another consciousness. We may not be aware of them, but they are there. It is like a blind man coming into the room, and he sees people there, although he does not see them physically, but he makes a greeting. So we are entering another world, another dimension, and they are there. Although we may not see them, perceive them directly, it is helpful to make a greeting. Just like saying, good morning. So if you believe in masters, in the angels, in invisible beings, just greet them. If you don't, that's fine. So you make a greeting, and then you recall that the night before we slept, we were reading something, and there was a particular statement there that somehow appealed to us, which we felt like underlining. So we take this now and we dwell on it as far as the meaning, significance of this statement that appealed to us the night before. So meditation has already started. So in a way, it becomes much easier. What is really taking place is the concentration and the focus. All right. Now, as we do this, one will find that we will start exhausting all the thoughts we can think of about this statement, this spiritual statement. So we have this spiritual statement, and here is our accumulation of thoughts, and we bring this to bear now on this idea. So what will happen is, we'll be rummaging upon our collection, looking for the meaning, the significance of this statement, until finally we exhaust this. So when that point has come, we come now to the second stage of the meditation. And this is the high point, and this is the real meditation. Since we are looking for thoughts, significance, meaning about a statement, and we cannot find any thoughts anymore, we are now in a state of no thought, even if we like to have a thought. Now, usually in meditation, we fight the thoughts. You know, these thoughts come, oh no, I shouldn't have thoughts. You know, I shouldn't have this. I should focus on this one thought. Even if one focuses on one thought, that thought on which focus is made must finally also be dropped. So it can be a mantra, whatever it is, an image of somebody, a person, an idea. But even that focus of the idea must finally be dropped. Then we enter the state of no thought. That state beyond alterations, that state beyond modifications, beyond this. And this is what determines finally the length of meditation. The first portion can take place maybe about 5 minutes. Roughly the second stage of no thought, maybe another 5 minutes. But the length of meditation really depends on the second one. Because in a state of really no thought, one can be there for 30 minutes, an hour, even beyond 2 hours, and one will feel like it was only 1 minute or 5 minutes. This is the one that determines, really, without effort, the length of meditation. This is that state where really the mind and all these accumulations is quiet. In that state, there are no words to describe it. But there are many books that make descriptions. Some say there's great bliss that is experienced. I have my doubts, this is true. Maybe there's great bliss, but together with this great bliss is also all the great sufferings of the world at large. And one experiences this together. So that when one comes out of it, one cannot say it's only bliss. That's merely 50%. But kindly not to expect this. There are some who say they experience great wisdom. This is probably half the truth. Because together with the great wisdom that one experiences, one will experience the darkest of ignorance experience also on the earth, so that when one comes out of it, maybe this explains why those who have truly realized do not carry any pride whatsoever or a superior than thou attitude, because in the experience of wisdom, they also experience the most ignorance, the greatest ignorance, the greatest darkness of ignorance of the world together. So when they come out of it, they are not only wise, they are also as ignorant as they are wise. In other words, some kind of resolution of polarity takes place within one's consciousness. Wisdom and ignorance, bliss and sorrow and suffering. And maybe there is another one. In that state of realization, one finds that all beings are also in that same state of realization. All beings, everything in the universe is also experiencing that realization. And maybe this explains why those who come out of this cannot say, I have realized and they have not. Because in that state of realization, one finds all beings are also in that state of realization, whether in their outer consciousness they are realizing it or not. Now this takes place there, and 5 minutes, 2 hours, time is not of the matter here. One will feel like it has only been a few minutes or even a second. So whether something happens or not, So long as we try as much to be quiet without really trying, we just let go. After that 5 minutes, then we spend the last 5 minutes. Since we are entering a state of no thought, no matter how brief that has been or whether it has taken place or not, let it be that in the last 5 minutes, if we are to have a thought now, let it be that the first thought we will have is not of ourselves but of another. So we are getting out of this self, this thought of oneself. So this is what we might call the good wish. Have a thought, take any place in the world where there is a need for a good wish. Maybe in the Middle East they are fighting. May they release the hostages. Somewhere there are religious wars going on. May there be peace there. Or somebody who is sick, may this person get well. Or somebody who is searching for something and is great trouble, may he find, and so on. May their pains be alleviated. Take a person, a group, or a certain place, or the world at large, and make a good wish. There are two ways of doing this. One is to make a good wish directly, and the other is to make it indirectly. I prefer the one where we do it indirectly. When we do something that is direct, like if somebody is thirsty and we have water and says, you know, I'd like some water, can you give me water? So if I give this person water and I have, and my water is, and we are a channel, and let's say we are a pipe or a glass, that is the channel. And if the glass is dirty, not clean, or there's rust in the pipe, while we give water, we also give our own rust. So the indirect way is, if we believe, we just say believe, that there are beings more superior than us, who know what to do with these energies, whatever you call them, God, angels, masters, make the offering to them and let them do the giving directly. So we make an offering to them, have the powers, the vision, and the wisdom to use the energy with the good wish, and if there is any rust and any dirt there, they filter it out. And we do this indirectly. And that is the last 5 minutes. So first 5 minutes, we dwell on a thought where we exhaust all the thoughts that we have. The second 5 minutes is the real meditation of no thought. And the last 5 minutes is, if we are to have a thought, the thought first is about service to others. Then at the end now, the critical point, first critical point here is the no thought, and the last, the ending. Let it be that at the end of the meditation, when you stand up, although we end the meditation in a sense like we're sitting down and, you know, we are going into our duties into the world, what we do is, psychologically, the meditation does not end within us. Whatever the mode and feeling is within us, we carry this now as we go into the outside world. So open the eyes slowly and stand up and walk now, whatever we have to do. Prepare to go to work, clean the house or whatever, or walk around the garden and so on, go to our jobs. We wake up now and carry this mode and feeling into the outside world. Then at noontime, for 2 minutes, take time out to recharge, to capture that ending meditation, and then to continue it again, that mode and feeling for about 2 minutes, and then open one's eyes, and then relate to the world again the way we related in that morning. Then at sunset, we do this again for another 2 minutes. So this is 3 meditations a day. 15 minutes in the morning, 2 minutes at noon, 2 minutes during sunset, and then when we go to sleep, we read certain spiritual things. It is a form of meditation also, but the intense meditation is in the morning. So we might say we have 4 meditation points now during the day. In 1 week, this will be how many? 4 times 7, 28. In 1 month, that will be 120, right? 1 month, 120 meditations, 4 times 30, 120. Let's say about 100 a month. 20 were not done. You get up on the wrong side of the bed or something like that. And so you have 100 in 1 month. Since there are 12 months in a year, this will be 1,200 meditations. Right? Yes. 1,200. Let's say we even drop the 200, and then let's say there's only 1,000 meditations a year. 1 year, 1,000, 2 years, 2,000, 3 years, 3,000, 4 years, 4,000. If one stays 4 years in college, they give you a diploma. And I'm sure the universe cannot be less than that. If you take 2 more years, you may probably get a PhD, and probably this more than this. So if one does this, somewhere there, it will happen. It will happen. There is no way that it can escape whatever we are looking for. But whatever happens need not take place during the meditation. It can take place even in between the meditations. So I recall once, he was an old man, past his 80s, and this was a talk on meditation, and he came forward and said, you know, being you were describing, we were describing certain states, meditation states, and he said, I have not experienced any of these things you have talked about. Somehow, I found myself making this statement. How about in between your meditations? And he had a cane, and he stamped his cane and walked away. And he was looking upwards and talking to himself. Of course, in between my meditations. It need not happen during the meditation. So the meditation we do in the morning determines the quality of life that we live after that meditation throughout the day, and the quality of life we live in between the two meditations, and that meditation we started the day before in the morning determines the quality of this next meditation of the second day. And this meditation of the first day and the quality of life we live and this meditation of the second day determines the quality of life that follows up to the next meditation, and so on cumulatively, until finally a time comes, that which we are looking for we find is ourselves gone past all these accumulations that we have been involved with. Then that which we speak of as the higher self, the volitional principle, the intuitional principle, or the abstractional nature within us, the source of ideals, and the intuitional, the source of virtue, we find is our true and very nature. All that we are trying to do is merely to express it within ourselves in the lower realms of what we call now the lower quaternary, the physical, the emotional, and the mental. Maybe we can erase a portion of this here to illustrate how meditation relates to other activities which we do in life. So we have here the body, we have our mind, or thought, our mental nature, and we have our emotions. And we have here meditation. And it is not enough to simply meditate. One must study. And there must be service. So we can study, but if we do not meditate, probably nothing will really happen. We can do a lot of service. If there is no meditation and no study, probably nothing will really happen. We can do a lot of study and no meditation, no service. Whatever we are looking for probably may not really happen. Something might happen, but whatever we are looking for, if we would like to make this experiential within us, the meditation helps in our studies. And the study helps in our meditation, and the meditation and study must finally express itself in service, and as we serve, it enables us to meditate better and to study better. The three must somehow go together. So if we allocate time for meditation, allocate time for study, and allocate time for service. The service can begin with the jobs that we have and the responsibilities we have assumed in life, and we leave the three together. What we are really trying to do is to take hold of the emotion, the mental and the body, and to put it under devolution, to put it under our control. We're using the word control here in a very special way. We do not mean domination. It is as we understand these processes that takes place within our consciousness, where control takes place without any effort whatsoever of exercising control. Because the moment we see the processes that take place within our consciousness, the seeing of the process is in itself the realization. And when one sees this, the process is a release from the contents in our consciousness. And these are the contents in our consciousness. And so not to get caught in the contents, but to see the processes. The moment we understand the processes, then one gets freed from the contents that alter, that modify our consciousness. In that state, we find now that the principles and ideas that we study in theosophy now become experiential within one's consciousness. And as one goes through life, almost when we see certain things happen, then somehow it begins to relate to the things that we study. We say, I knew this before as a thought, I see this now happening. And almost when anything almost happens within our life, we can already see the result. The moment the object is there, then you can watch the senses. There is a study which says the senses are the engines of our consciousness. It doesn't say engine. They use the word horses, but we are putting this in mechanical terms. The senses are like engines in our consciousness. And the contact is provided by the body. So the body is like the car. And the senses keeps this contact, the body, running. And then the thoughts now that we experience, it is said, are like the reins. In our case, it will be the steering wheel. And then that which now, who is the driver, is something beyond this. But this driver, we call it the soul, the spirit, the spiritual self, is immersed now, and is now clothed in this accumulation, and it is now, thinks now, it is the self, when it is not this. This is the illusion of the separate self. And so the freeing of this takes place when one sees the processes that take place within our consciousness. My friends, experiment with these ideas. Put it to a test. Set a time for meditation in the morning. Study theosophy. Take time out to do something of service, not for ourselves, but for another. And do the meditation regularly and the study regularly. The best time to study is after the meditation, if not possible. Maybe before going to sleep, one might do this study. And the service is the life we live in between the two meditations and the two times we have set for study. And when one does this, a time comes when the things that we know as thoughts, ideas, concepts become a reality within our consciousness. This is the real transformation that can take place in the world. We cannot transform another. We can only transform our own consciousness. And so when each person does his or her own transformation, collectively now, we transform the world. And we begin only with ourselves. May it be that more of us, more and more, and day to day, shall come to this transformation and this realization and experience that finally verifies the truths that we simply speak as theosophy. Maybe we can open this for some questions or comments you would like to make. Yes, Bill. What lodge should the members to join?
No, the minister.
Oh, I see, what lodge? Oh, that minister. He didn't join any lodge. He left me his card. This was many years back. he asked me to come to his, to come to his parish or congregation. But I was traveling and I couldn't go there. If I had time, I would have gone there. Because then if you go there, then he might come also to the Theosophical Society. It works this way. People say, why are they not interested in the society? Let us be interested in their society, their religion. And then likewise, they might be interested in our society. Yes, I hope he's doing very well. Yes.
I have trouble being quiet, trapping my thoughts.
Yeah.
One of the processes that happens to me is I start to fight like crazy.
Yes.
I get real angry at myself.
Yes.
So if you can make
it, now, this is a... Everyone experiences this. The question is, I have trouble being quiet, and how do we resolve this? So the question is, who is it in us that is not quiet? and that in within us. And kindly not to listen to the answer as much as see this answer in the manner it takes place within our consciousness. Who is it in me that is not quiet? This one. And it is the nature of this accumulation to be very noisy. Why? That is the way it calls attention to itself. So what happens when we say, well, I want to quiet this? The mere fact of quieting it makes it noisier. So the seeing of that which is noisy in us is in itself the quieting. Say, now who is doing this noise? You see this. See this one, sometimes, you know, this one can break off. Let's just flip this. So we drew this like this, you know, because in our first meeting we touched on this, you know, these are the thoughts we like and these are the thoughts we dislike. And then we identify with the thoughts we like, and then we look at this, and we look at these thoughts we dislike, and then it says, you're very noisy. I want to be quiet. You know, I like thoughts that are quiet. So we see this process that is taking place within us. And of course, we study some more. We read some more. So we accumulated more thoughts now that we like. Then it likes this much better than this. So it looks at this now and said, oh, before you were very quiet. Now you're the one that's also noisy. Yeah, because it is now identified with the new thoughts. And to just see this process, the seeing of it, and when we look at it, we do not evaluate, we do not analyze, we do not conclude, we do not interpret, just look. And this is what we do in that second 5 minutes in the meditation. When a thought arises, don't engage it, just look. The moment we say, oh, I shouldn't have this thought, I should be in a state of no thought, I must do this, then this is a thought of having no thought. So simply look and not do anything, just look and observe and watch. What happens when one is able to transcend this and sees this? Symbolically, we become the blackboard. We do not lose ourselves, see? We become the blackboard. And one is the blackboard. All of these are taking place, but we are not identified with that which is taking place. We are the blackboard itself. The blackboard completely remains unmodified. You can write anything on it, it still remains the way it is. There is another experiment you like in helping to resolve thoughts. Try to put the thought or the awareness on the breath. And you can experiment with this. This is helpful. You can do this even throughout the day. But just be careful. If one is driving or operating certain machineries, you know, one has to be very, very alert. But try putting it on the breath. In fact, in the Bible it said, God took a lump of earth, and he molded it, and he breathed into it the breath of life. So this breath that we have is God's breath. In fact, take away the breath, there is no life. So maybe somewhere here, the secret of life is in the breath. No life, maybe no consciousness. No consciousness, no life. They're almost identified with each other. And so if we put this consciousness, maybe we might discover there the secret of life. And experiment it with life, in the life that we live, putting it on the breath. Because the breath has no evaluation. You know, the breath is very neutral. The air that comes into our nostrils does not say, are you Republican or Democratic? I won't go inside your lungs. It doesn't say that. You know, are you for ERA or against ERA? Or else I won't fill your lungs with oxygen. It doesn't. In the language of Jesus, it maketh the rain to fall on the just and the unjust. Likewise with the breath. It cometh to the lungs of the just and the unjust. It makes no discrimination whatsoever. So try putting it in the breath. I'll tell you a little story on breath. This was one place where, you know, this can sound very impractical, but somebody's job got saved because of this practice. And I got to know it the following year that I visited the place again. And then he said, you know, I experimented with this breath you were talking about. He said, and he was operating some machinery where you feed the machinery. It must be a punch press. And he had a few more years to retirement. And the last time I saw him, that was the first time I saw him, he said, you know, I'm worried I might get laid off. You know, we do contracts for trucks, and trucks aren't selling and all that, because the Japanese trucks are the ones selling now. So I might get laid off. Then he said, you know, I experimented with this breathing in my work, and he said, I found out that I could rearrange my work, like getting the materials, feeding it, and then operating the switch in a way where it synchronized with my breath. Because as he became aware of his breath, when he did this jump, he found out that his movements did not synchronize with his breath, and he felt awkward, only because he was aware of his breath. So he arranged his working materials to harmonize with his breath. And he found out that he could do 400% more without any effort. And he said if he exerted effort, it would go 500 to 600% production. And because of this, it reached the management, and he was not on the layoff list. They said, this is the person we would like to keep, you know, on the job. And he said, so thank you for the breath. He said, because of the breath, somehow it saved my job. And there are many things like this in the study of theosophy. They can look very innocuous and very impractical, but there are statements and principles that if one lives the spiritual life, the material life takes care of itself. Seek ye first the kingdom of heaven and its righteousness, and all these things shall be added unto you, in the language of Ephesians. Yes. Yes, please. Do all thoughts exist forever? Possibly they are always there. You know, in theosophy there is a term called pralaya. Maybe when pralaya comes, then, you know, the thoughts become non-existent, because manifestation, even in the thought world, begins to withdraw. But the thing is, all of beings who think, they are called dhyanis, you know, who think, or manas, they generate these thoughts, and they float in the mental atmosphere, and they enter our mental bodies. So whether we generate them on our own or not, they can come into us, and we feel they are our own thoughts. And this is where meditation comes, because when one is aware of one's consciousness, then in this awareness of one's consciousness, then the thoughts are there, but we do not get involved in them. So we'll say the thoughts are always there, but there is a time in manifestation when all thoughts, because all thought matter, astral and emotional matter, are withdrawn into a state of what is called simply pralaya. But as long as there is manifestation, the thoughts are there forever. But whether they participate in our consciousness or not is another thing. So they may be there, but so long as one does not get caught and involved with it. And usually, we get caught with this accumulation. And this is the one that catches more thoughts. In fact, this is how it preserves its own existence, by collecting more thoughts. And it will rationalize, it will trick us, you know. In the Bible, this is the symbol of Herod. You know, when we do our first spiritual efforts, this Herod will kill all our firstborn spiritual efforts. This is the one, the past, the accumulation. Yes. They become sensitive. Yeah, that's true. The question is whether one becomes sensitive. There is no question that one becomes sensitive the moment we meditate. Things that otherwise we would have not noticed, we begin to notice them. That is why in meditation, study must take place. Then the service that we live. By service here, we live the life as much as possible. In fact, if you take like the yoga systems, before even meditation is attempted, there are virtues to be lived. So we live the quality of life in between meditations that helps now our next meditation that follows. So in that way, although we become more sensitive, while we become sensitive to the negative things taking place in the world, there is also the sensitivity to the positive things that are taking place in the world. In the, pardon? These are abnormalities, yes. The question is, you know, who is it in us that is sensitive? And you will find that this is the one. This is the one that is sensitive to the noise. The only noise it would like to listen to is its own noise. It doesn't like to listen to somebody else's noise. And that is the way it intensifies its life and preserves itself. This must be sacrifice. Sacrifice, the word sacrifice means to make whole, to make holy. So one is not whole because this one divides. So we are divided from another because what we accumulate is different from somebody else's accumulation. If there are no more questions, yes, Bob?
Would you say one is spirit and one is matter?
You could, if you like, yeah. In a way, emotion, mental, and body is concerned with matter, and meditation, study, and service, while concerned with matter, really is the spirit liberating itself from matter. And of course, this is the symbol of the society. That which is trying to do that is man, we. That's the symbol. You know, first it is like this. That's the one-track mind. Then it studies things like that, begins to open up a little. That is the Ankh of Egypt. Then finally it fully realizes a full circle. Like that. This is the exoteric, this is the mesoteric, this is the esoteric. Esoteric because it relates to our own consciousness. That forever remains esoteric. Thank you, Bob. Yeah, Bob is mentioning that there is a mural there outside, and it is a sweeping, you might say, painting or mural about certain processes of evolution and involution that take place within the universe. And I think there's a leaflet that describes it. Yes. No difference. Question is, what is the difference between knowledge and accumulation? There is no difference. All the knowledge that we think is knowledge is really accumulation. Now, this has its proper place. Huh? Knowledge has its proper place in relation to the physical, emotional, and mental world. But the moment we take knowledge and we leave the knowledge, because one can have knowledge and not live it, the moment knowledge is lived with virtue, so we have knowledge plus virtue, then now we have wisdom. One can have virtue, but without knowledge, one isn't wise. So we take the knowledge and add into it the virtue that enables us to live real spiritual knowledge, and then it brings about wisdom. Now, we do not belittle, you know, the thoughts and the accumulation. We do not. This is very useful in the physical, emotional, and mental world. Useful. But if we are trying to enter a world, a state of consciousness, or a dimension beyond the physical, emotional, and mental, all thoughts, all emotions, and all actions, physical, are totally and completely useless. They have to be set aside. So this is the classic analogy we use. The car is very useful up to the parking lot. But if we are to enter this other state of consciousness in the library, we have to leave the car behind. Afterwards, the car is useful. So this one is useful, studying, you know, getting place in the world, but then we meditate and know we are more than this accumulation. And after that, it is useful again, and it has its proper place. Thank you. Have a nice evening.